If you're trying to understand a place like the Pacific Northwest, of course you can go to the history, or you can go to the census to see the demographics of the people who live here, or you can just pick up a paper or tune into a newscast on public radio. But there's another way too. We can look to the stories that we tell about ourselves, our myths and legends.
Raven was walking along the beach, and it was the beginning of time.
There's one thing about Scoop Jackson. You know where he stands.
There are no abominable snowmen. There are no Sasquatches.
But how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us.
Well, we're going to make your music into a religion, a little more than just a fad.
That's Edward Cullen. It's totally gorgeous, obviously.
Obviously. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Team Edward. This is Sound Effect, and this week we are going to dig into some of that mythology to try and wrestle with not exactly whether it's true, but what truths the stories reveal about us, the storytellers. Lots more on that, but first we're going to have some friends over to help us get caught up on the week's news, so stick around. Well, here we are once again. We have a pretty obvious choice for a top story of the week, although we do have at least one alternative out of the mainstream choice, too. We're going to get to that as well as our nominees for overreported and underreported stories of the week. With our three guests here, I'm joined today by Justin Carter. He's founder of Capitol Hill Seattle blog. Jessica Partnow is co-founder and executive director of the Seattle Globalist. And Benjamin Romano is editor of Exconomy Seattle. Hey, guys. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi.
How's it going?
So, you know, top story. We've been unable to escape this in the last 4 weeks or so. So might as well dive right into that top story. Benjamin Romano.
Seattle Seahawks in the Super Bowl for the second year in a row.
I heard something about that. What is it about that story that's capturing your attention and fascination right now besides just being excited?
Right. Well, it's inescapable. But I also think it's a great reflection of the mood in Seattle right now, apart from the sports aspect of it. We're living in a great time, I think. There's certainly a lot of problems, but, you know, our economy is doing pretty well. There's construction cranes everywhere. Some of them are trying to rescue our trap tunnel boring machine. people are planning and doing and raising money for a lot of interesting innovation in healthcare, retail, data storage, space exploration. So I just feel like it's a great time to be living in Seattle. And, you know, the Seahawks have put us again on the national stage, and I think Seattle looks good right now.
So Seahawks is kind of a metaphor for optimism here in Seattle and in the Northwest. I like that. And how about you, Justin? What's your nomination for top story of the week?
Well, I mean, I'll take the Super Bowl too, of course, but I'll take it for a slightly different reason. I like it for its unifying aspects. It's a thing for the bros and the woo girls and the drag queens, the social activists, everybody to kind of get together and be Seattle, and that's a pretty fun opportunity. The idea that we get to go through it a second time means, man, we even have like a greatest hits playlist of cool Seahawks songs to listen to. It's pretty interesting times.
All right, well, let's have an alternative choice. Our maverick today, Jessica Partnow from Seattle Globalist. What's your choice for top story?
So nothing against the Seahawks because I love them and I can't wait for Sunday. But my top story this week was about bilingual education or immersion, dual language schools in the Seattle area, because my colleague, Sarah Studeville, covered one school in the Highline School District that is dual language Vietnamese and English. And so that's not the same as like going to French class second period. It's actually half of your study is happening in Vietnamese and the other half in English. And she found out that the top five languages spoken by students other than English here are Spanish, Vietnamese, Somali, Tagalog, and Cantonese. And we only have programs available in Spanish, Japanese, and Mandarin, and then this one in Vietnamese. So looking at those community languages and how students could actually be studying.
That's great choices for top story of the week. So we're going to move on now to our overreported story of the week. Jessica Partnow, what is the story that you have had just about enough of this week?
Well, honestly, the snowstorm on the East Coast. I went to college in New York, and I remember when I lived there, my family back home would always be like, oh, it's so cold, you know, oh, are you okay with the snow, all of that. And I was like, why do you know so much about the weather? It's like not that big of a deal. I mean, obviously, when it is dangerous situation. I understand why it happens, but I just heard too much about it this week.
Benjamin Romano, what is your choice for overreported story?
Well, this might be a cop-out, but it's almost by definition that the Super Bowl is the most overcovered story ever anywhere. And, I think we're living in the city with, the team returning to the game. We're experiencing that. But I'm also not tired of it. So that's sort of a paradox. I can't get enough of it. So.
Any particular excesses in terms of coverage that you have found especially funny or ridiculous?
Well, I think outside of the game itself, the way some of the Seahawks players are subverting the NFL and, playing all the way to the edge of their sort of ridiculous media rules. And I think just doing a really good job of bringing the game to their own terms.
Well, at least it can distract us from Deflategate.
Yeah.
So, Justin Carter, what is your nominee for Overreported Story of the Week?
Well, I should probably preface it and include that my over and under are all twisted together here.
But rolled up into one.
Yeah, I mean, as far as overreported, I think it's the reaction to the all the ongoing troubles with the Seattle Police Department and the focus on the rules or the focus on the punishments of individuals. It's become almost irritating to me as a reporter that there's so much focus on that.
Is it these individual episodes that have kind of gotten attention that have grabbed headlines about in this kind of ridiculous sounding arrest or this iffy situation?
It gets reduced to these kind of almost strange, almost like trivial kind of small things that are then kind of easily explained away or can be easily explained away, or they can be taken like the police union has done and twisted. And so now an officer who's accused of some kind of ugly things is the victim because she's getting mean emails. Putting those story into those kinds of contexts just opens up for, I think, whittling away at a bigger problem.
All right, well, so that's your overreported story of the week, Justin Carter. What is your underreported story of the week? What's something that you think ought to be getting more attention?
I haven't read, we're working on it too, and what do we do, actually? What does reform really look like? I don't see anybody reporting on it, really. Is it just O'Toole? Is it just the chief? Is she really going to just be the person that fixes all this? It seems like unlikely. And so, for some reason, we're skipping all that and not really looking forward. Yeah, and maybe it's the news cycle, but it felt like in this time especially, there's just been a reluctance to look past the incidents and look at a bigger picture.
So the substance of police reform, that's your nominee for Undercovered Story of the Week. Jessica Partnow, Seattle Globalist, what is your underreported story of the week?
This week, the one that really grabbed my attention was that we had a protest earlier in the week from local Gambians living in Seattle in support of a coup attempt that happened a couple of months ago. And I read the story and I was kind of like, what? There was a coup attempt in Gambia? And we have a Gambian American population here in Seattle. I just hadn't heard a lot about the situation and was surprised. And it was actually two U.S. citizens who attempted to start this coup in Gambia and are now in a lot of trouble because U.S. citizens are not allowed to attack other countries' governments unless it's a wartime.
Oh, that's fascinating. So pro-coup demonstration by a Gambian community here in Seattle. That's your underreported story of the week. Well, it's definitely underreported. And so, Benjamin Romano, what's your underreported story?
There was a report out from the Economic Policy Institute this week that found income growth in Washington during the economic recovery, so from 2009 to 2012, has gone almost entirely to the richest 1% of people, while everyone else saw their incomes decline in that period. And so this is a huge issue, and I think the big story we're going to all be watching is in Olympia in the coming months to see, what are our lawmakers going to be doing to improve the quality and access to education at all levels that are going to prepare Washingtonians to work in the kind of tech industry jobs that pay enough to be able to afford to live in Seattle anymore. And so a big part of that proposal is a capital gains tax that's going to basically reach right into the pockets of a lot of people who invest in and build companies in the tech economy, and those are the same people who are clamoring for more trained workers to fill their open positions. So I'm going to be watching closely how they respond to that capital gains tax proposal and whether they're going to support it.
All right. Well, those are great nominees for over and underreported story from our guests today. So we are talking a little bit today in our show about Northwest myths and legends, and I use those kind of terms in the broadest sense. And I was wondering if there are some Northwest myths you guys would like to put to bed or conversely, some Northwest myths that you think are particularly, I don't know, fun, illustrative, meaningful to you? And I'll start with you, Jessica Partnow. What do you think about in terms of Northwest myths?
Well, I chose one that I kind of want to be put to bed, or at least that I want us to change the way we think about. And it's the myth that Seattle is a white city. I think that there are a lot of ways that Seattle is less diverse than other big cities in this country, certainly. But we're a place that has incredible international diversity. And if you look just outside the Seattle city limits, we actually are becoming more diverse at sort of an exponential rate. And if you look at the past decade, the increase in diversity is just more than anywhere else in the country is happening. We also are a place that is known as hyper-diverse. So that means that we have lots and lots of different groups of people, and no one of those groups is much bigger than any other. So it's a unique kind of diversity. And I think that it remains true that in a lot of ways, Seattle is a very segregated city. But I'm really excited. I think the conversation has started, and I think it's going to continue to get bigger.
All right. There's one Northwest myth that Jessica Partnow has had just about enough of. And how about you, Justin? What do you think about in terms of Northwest myths?
Such a party pooper that I'm going to also take a swipe at one just to get rid of it. I'm tired of having people tell me about all the condos on Capitol Hill and all those, look at those condos that are getting built. They're not condos, folks. Those are expensive apartments. And so I guess until we get a better name for expensive apartments, we can call them condos. But I guess the core of that that always bothers me was, besides the inaccuracies, these are also tenants. These are also renters. And there could be almost, I don't know, maybe more of a shared culture among folks that are looking at the problems of affordability in the city and on Capitol Hill. And if everyone realized that, you know, these are not that different from where we are. This may be a fancier apartment, but they're also tenants. They're living a lifestyle that's a lot closer to mine than people who are in single-family homes, for example. And so I guess I'd like to see better sisterhood and brotherhood among the tenants of the city when we're looking up at the stuff that's getting built.
So the divisive myth of Capitol Hill condos,
sure.
One that you would like to put to bed. But in some ways, maybe it isn't that new. This gets into your nominee for a Northwest myth. I think one that you would like to celebrate, if I'm not mistaken, Benjamin.
Oh, absolutely. So mine is the Weedle on the Needle. And this is a story to explain why there is a blinking red light on the top of the Space Needle. It's a book that's about 40 years old now, written by Stephen Cosgrove, a children's book. And there's so much in it. It's about newcomers to the city and change and development and letting your neighbor be. And the Weedle, for those who don't know, is a large orange fuzzy creature who's just trying to get a good night's sleep.
The guy just wants to get a good night's sleep, and everyone's whistling around him.
That's
right.
That's right. Yeah, whistling while they work, whistling while they build South Lake Union. Many iterations of it ago before Amazon, before the warehouse district, back when it was steamships and sail ships.
Right, Northwest myths and legends. Thank you so much to our panelists, Benjamin Romano of Exconomy Seattle, Jessica Partnow of Seattle Globalist, and Justin Carter of Capitol Hill Seattle Blog. Thank you so much for joining us on Sound Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. Go Seahawks.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This week, we are exploring Northwest myths and legends. And we have asked Roger Fernandez to come in to tell us a little bit about myths and legends from his point of view. He is a member of the Lower Elwha Band of the Sklallam Indians from the Port Angeles area. He's an educator and a storyteller and a guy who has thought a lot about the importance of myths and stories. The stories of our region's first people are part of his inheritance, and I think that for all of us, they kind of define what living here means. So when I sat down with Roger, we talked about why almost every culture values its stories so much.
The deeper you go into storytelling, the more you realize that it's just the foundation of how humans understand the world. And you have various people like, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell, people who go very deeply into the meaning of story and how they identify humans and their cultures. And so for me, it's pivotal. We remember through stories. We remember our history. We remember the meaning of things. What I like to say about the stories is that the mythic stories, the creation stories that all cultures tell, they explain how the world came to be, how the world works, and how you live in the world. So sometimes I look at the modern world and realize that that story doesn't really exist outside of religion now.
So we have a lot of other ways of kind of doing that now, though, right? We have other kinds of ways of passing on knowledge. We have not just an oral tradition, but we have written stuff. We have electronic records. We have written laws. Do we still need stories?
I really believe, now I've chosen to believe what I believe. My teachers told me various things as I was learning storytelling, and I chose to believe them. And so I operate from those principles they taught me. One is that the true power of storytelling is when we sit together, when human beings sit together, and the moisture of our breath combines. It's called conspiracy, to breathe together, to our breath mingle, our spirits mingle. And so in that, that's a true power of the story. It's a spiritual act. To Native people who still operate in a large regard around that spiritual beliefs of their ancestors, then it makes perfect sense that this is the truest form of humans communicating with each other. And that books, as powerful as they are, I love to read, are just short of that because we don't combine our breaths, our living breath together.
So a lot of what stories have done traditionally, by my understanding, is that they explain things in the natural world or explain how things came to be or why things are the way they are, why the seasons follow this pattern and so on. And we have whole other ways of understanding that now, particularly, you know, Western science. Do you see those things in opposition to one another?
We have multiple levels of who we are. Our brain is hungry for this kind of give me information, how many miles is the sun from the earth? And so that's feeding one part of ourselves, our brain. The stories oftentimes feed our brain, but also feed other parts of us that need reassurance that everything has meaning. Meaning is something that science can't give, in my opinion. Science can tell us facts and data and information, but it can't give meaning. I often say that, you know, the science can tell us how far the sun is from the earth, how hot the sun is, even when the sun is going to burn out. But science cannot tell us why the sun is. Why is the sun there? And that meaning comes from story and myth and religion and art and ceremony. And so they are in some ways different languages. We need our brain to help make sense of things. One teaching I was given is that our heart tells us the good thing we want to do first. Our brain helps us figure out how to do it. Without your heart involved, it becomes, you know, where we can develop bombs that destroy all living life in a city, but let the building stand. For me, there's I guess a certain morality to it, and ethics to it as well.
So they dovetail. I mean, do you think that they go together? They
complement
each other.
Yeah, they certainly should. I know that I quote Einstein a lot, and he said, you know, imagination is more important than knowledge. Just knowing things isn't sufficient. You need to be able to do something with that. Creative act is the most powerful form of what we can do with that knowledge.
Well, I'd love to hear a story. Would you share one with us?
Sure. I'll share a small story from the local tribes. I heard this from the Suquamish people first. A long time ago, clams had feet. Clams walked everywhere. Everywhere you went, there were clams everywhere. If you were, you know, waking up in the morning, there'd be clams standing around your room. If you were out working on the beach in the day, carving a canoe, there'd be clams standing there watching you. Up in the mountains, gathering berries, there'd be clams watching you. Wherever you went, there were clams. Clams were everywhere. And they were always watching you. They were watching you all the time. Well, if that wasn't bad enough, at night when you were asleep, the clams would get together and they would talk about you. They would tell all the other clams what they saw you doing, good, bad, or otherwise. They would tell everybody what they saw you doing. And sometimes they would embellish a story to make it more exciting or more interesting. And so the clams were gossiping. They were gossiping all the time. So this is how the world was. Clams everywhere, watching you, talking about you. Well, one day Raven, that big blackbird Raven, he was way out in the woods, somewhere way far out in the woods by himself, and he was doing something really bad. I don't know what it was, but it must have been really bad because he was trying to hide what he was doing. Well, Raven finished doing this bad thing. He turned around, and there was little clam looking at him. And Raven said, hey, I didn't know you were there. Please don't tell anyone. Promise you won't tell anyone what you saw me doing. And the little clam said, I promise, Raven, I won't tell anyone. Raven said, I really mean this now. You have to be serious. Promise you won't tell anybody what you saw me doing. And the little clam said, what do you think I am? Of course I won't tell anyone. But when that little clam got home that night, guess what he did? He told everyone. He told everyone this terrible thing that Raven had done. Everything he saw that Raven had been doing, how Raven told him not to tell, and all these kind of things. Well, Raven found out about this, and he got very angry. He reached his black wings across the earth and gathered up all the clams between them and brought them back to the beach. He would drop a clam onto the sand and then put his foot upon it and drive it under the sand. He did this over and over and over until all the sand was filled with clams now. The clams were living under the sand. And he said, now when you open your mouth to gossip, water and sand will rush into your mouth. That is the punishment you will have for gossiping. But do you think that stopped the clams from gossiping? Of course not. When you walk across a wet and muddy beach, you'll see little spurts of water coming from under the sand. That is the clam people. They're still under the sand, and they're still talking and gossiping, and they're talking about you. And that is all. That story is called The Gossiping Clams.
The Gossiping Clams. What a marvelous story. So what is the nugget of that jumps out to you most as being wise or funny or having some kind of piece of truth in it?
It is as though human beings are social animals, and we are watched all the time. We are watched by our family, by our friends, by our community all the time. And so we are behaving because we know we're being watched. And if you violate that, then again, there are consequences to that. And then the other thing is, the idea of the consequences. And sometimes even the consequences don't stop us from doing the thing we're not supposed to do. So the clams still gossip, even though they were punished for it. So there's all kinds of little things that you could take those concepts and apply them to something else. And I do storytelling now in treatment centers that where Native people are struggling with drug and alcohol addictions. And when we talk about the stories and addictions through the stories, then it becomes a different conversation. It's the important conversation, but just from a story perspective, where we're not talking about them and their problem, but about a character in the story and their problem, and how do they relate and what do they find in it. So for me then, that little story about the gossiping clams is very simple, but sometimes the simplest stories are the deepest.
Well, Roger Fernandez is a member of the Lower Elwha Band of the Sklallam Indians from the Port Angeles, Washington area. He's an artist and an educator and, of course, a storyteller. Thank you so much, Roger.
Well, thank you for having me. Happy to share these things.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're talking about myths and legends today, and now we move on to something of an urban legend. And by that, I don't necessarily mean it's not true, although more on that in a minute, but more that it's one of these very common legends that just seems to pop up in city after city. I can't tell you how many places I've lived that have this same legend that there are, underneath the city, hidden underground tunnels, rife with mystery and intrigue. And I don't know why it is, but one of the most persistent versions of this legend happens to be in Tacoma. And that's interesting because there's almost no actual evidence of these tunnels, no remnants of tunnels, no reliable forensic evidence of any kind. And so KPLU's Kevin Kniestad set out to get to the bottom of this legend, figure out if it's true and what it means. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Gabe.
So what are some of the stories that are kind of attached to these underground tunnels, these alleged underground tunnels in Tacoma?
Well, like in a lot of cities, there's lots of stories and lots of speculation. There's stories of brothels and taverns having these trap doors with tunnels that would lead to secret basements, and the owners of these establishments would get clientele good and intoxicated to the point of passing out, drop them down through these secret doors, through these secret tunnels, into secret basements, and basically sell these poor souls off to trading ships in Commencement Bay before they came to and would end up being put to work on these boats. And that's actually a very common urban legend for a lot of West Coast port cities. Other legends suggest a tunnel where businessmen could park their wagons on one side of the street, walk into a legitimate business, then crawl into a tunnel in that legitimate business, which led under the street to brothels or opium dens or perhaps even bars during Prohibition in another location.
Okay, this is starting to sound familiar. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've heard versions of this before where it's a den of vice or an mm-hmm. iniquity and the tunnels are conveyances to and from in secret. So is that mostly what you've heard about these Tacoma tunnels?
Actually, the most common stories seem to revolve around Chinese immigrants living in Tacoma, but the accounts seem to vary. So I went to Tacoma, where I found Phyllis Harrison. She's done extensive research on the subject of these so-called Chinese tunnels. And we started our conversation by talking about the stories she heard growing up.
The stories that I heard were, for the most part, that there was a network of tunnels under North and West Tacoma that had been built by the railroads, and they were used to smuggle coolie laborers, which was the term that we used at that time, into Tacoma to work on the railroads. My father had heard the same story. He told us about being in a tunnel out by Fircrest, an area that is now called China Lake, that he'd been in an entrance to such a tunnel. And he described it as a cave. It had fallen in, it was blocked off, whatever, you couldn't go very far. And he said there were actually bunks in there and that they had found some Chinese coins.
So, Gabe, those were the stories that Phyllis knew as a child.
Okay, so childhood stories are one thing. But what did she discover once she started to get into her, like, actual academic research?
Well, once she started working on her doctoral degree in folklore, she found out the story that she knew as a child was not at all the story that was told in the latter third of the 1800s.
Chinese immigrants played a large part in settling Tacoma in the early days, as they did up and down the West Coast, partly because they were willing to do the work that other people were not necessarily willing to do, and they didn't have the opportunities that other people had. And in the 1860s, as things began to go a little bit sideways, for whatever reason, whether it was because people wanted jobs or needed a scapegoat or whatever, anti-Chinese sentiment grew pretty rapidly on the West Coast. And in Tacoma, it boiled over to the point that the Chinese community, which was largely in the area, I believe, around Stadium High School and what's now Schuster Parkway, were rounded up and driven out of town. It's an ugly piece in our history. So the earliest stories, accounts that I saw, say, from the late 1800s in Tacoma newspapers, talked about opium dens, Shanghaied sailors. They were not so much connected with the railroad as they were connected with very, very negative images of Chinese people and somehow images of danger and that sort of thing, danger to the Tacoma population. So it was a very negative stereotype.
So, Gabe, basically what you had in the beginning, in the origin of this story, is people in Tacoma needed an excuse, a justifiable excuse to drive Chinese immigrants out of Tacoma. So they painted this awful picture of things that they were allegedly doing, and that's the origin of the Tacoma Tunnel story.
I see, yeah. So it's kind of like it's propaganda in a way, but that has made its way into the realm of folklore. And in that sense, even if it's not true with a capital T, it still expresses a truth about the place that it comes from, about the attitudes and the culture that it sprung from.
Right, and as the attitudes evolved, so did the story.
Over time, those stereotypes changed as the dominant culture perception of Chinese people changed, so that the story I grew up with was a little bit more sympathetic, suggesting somewhat the exploitation of Chinese immigrants to work on the railroads.
So that's some really interesting background on the evolution of this Tacoma Tunnel legend, but did you ever find any evidence that the tunnels even existed? Do you believe that these tunnels ever existed?
There was an abandoned railroad tunnel, and I believe that that is documented. And my interest as a folklorist, Kevin, I was interested in the stories people told. So I'm always hard-pressed when people say, when I was a kid, I believed implicitly there was this network of tunnels that opened into people's basements and on and on and on. When I was doing that research, it truly didn't matter that much to me whether or not there were tunnels. I was more concerned about what people said about them. To my knowledge, there's never been any tunnel documented that wasn't something like a steam tunnel under Stadium High School that didn't have some other explanation. And as I understand, I hope this won't be disappointing lots and lots of people, but as I understand it, the geography of Tacoma is such that it would highly unlikely that anybody could dig a vast system of tunnels.
Now, wait a second. I have to say, I do feel a little disappointed. I hate to admit it, but I kind of wanted there to be tunnels under Tacoma. I want there to be this secret world that you can't see, this hidden world. I don't know. Did you feel that way?
You're disappointed. I'm disappointed. I went looking for these things. I took this dark walk down the stairway in the basement of an old bar that used to be a brothel 100 years ago to the sealed off door, hoping that I would find something that no one in Tacoma had found before. But there's really no evidence to it. And as Phyllis says, it's not about the evidence. It's not about being able to find these tunnels. It's about the stories.
I think that we are a community that's very connected with the past. Our dramatic and unfortunate history with Chinese immigrants certainly has got to have something to do with how those stories have developed.
That is Phyllis Harrison. She has a doctorate in folklore, and she has spent years researching the alleged underground tunnels in Tacoma, and she talked about it with KPLU's Kevin Kniestad. Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Gabe.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are exploring some of our region's myths and legends. So this next legend is a dark one, and you need to know that it does include some pretty disturbing discussion of violence. It's not appropriate for most kids. The story's about 9 minutes long. What we're doing is taking a look at a lesser-known chapter of the hunt for the serial killer Gary Ridgway, and it comes to us from Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix.
Do you remember where you were when you learned about the Green River Killer?
I was 12 years old. It was the summer of 1982. I was actually visiting my grandmother in Eastern Washington in a small town called Winthrop, Washington. And so here I was several hundred miles away from Seattle and reading about this horror show that is happening to Seattle, that is taking place in Seattle, where the bodies of the first 3 to 4 victims were found in the Green River.
That's Jeff Jensen. He's an entertainment writer and also the author of the book Green River Killer, a true detective story.
Everyone always told me, you're going to write a book about your dad one day.
Everyone always told him that because his dad was the main detective on the Green River Killer case. In fact, in his more than 20 years on the case, he put in more hours than even Dave Reichert. And I had the chance to talk with Jeff recently when he came to visit his now retired police detective dad. We discussed the case and the murders and the toll he watched it take on his father, and why he decided to write a graphic novel about the whole thing. But we focused on the end of his father's time on the case, and that's what his book focuses on. Because, as part of a plea deal, Gary Ridgway was moved into an office park at Boeing Field in the summer of 2003, and he lived there, on a mattress in an empty room, with 24-hour armed guards at the door, and cubicles outside of it where the detectives would sit.
To go 20 years searching for this guy, to now just like coming to work every day and walking past Gary Ridgway in the morning like, Gary, Tom.
It took 3 times longer than they thought it would to get the evidence they needed from Ridgway. Jeff's father, Detective Jensen, was there for all 188 long days of it. And when I spoke with Jeff, I asked him about his father's experience questioning Ridgway and what that process was like.
What they encountered right away with him was this fuzzy memory, the imprecise recollection of each victim, sometimes certain memories of killing one person blurring into another, and an odd reticence to him. Like they couldn't quite figure him out. And over that first weekend of interviewing him, this thing emerged where it's like, why is he like this? Surely he should be able to remember. Is he holding things back? Is that possible? I mean, he's here to tell us everything. Why is he holding back on some things? And there were some things that in particular the detectives knew that they believed that the Green River Killer should know. One of them being necrophilia. They knew that he had had sex with the victims after he'd killed them. But he wouldn't go there. I mean, he wouldn't talk about that, and he denied doing that for 72 hours of the whole investigation.
there is a breakthrough of the many breakthroughs that I want to ask you about. And it's when your father was questioning Gary Ridgway and he himself broke down in the questioning. When was that in this timeline and what happened?
So on the morning of the fifth day, my father and another detective, John Mattson, led Gary into sort of like a conversation about any number of things. But the thing that they zeroed in on right away is necrophilia. So my father and John Mattson kind of conducted this interview in which they kind of like just made Gary feel safe and even empathized with him and kind of convinced him that this was something that he needed to disclose. And he went from admitting, yes, I did have sex with one body, to confessing that he had sex with several bodies. Now, as this is playing out in the room, a number of emotional reactions are happening in the detectives and even in Gary, with Gary's lawyers. One is they knew that they had had a breakthrough. He was finally giving some stuff up. So there was a sense of triumph. But what he was also admitting to was it was disturbing. And so it was very troubling to hear. And my dad in particular, in that moment, interviewing him, was feeling all of these things. I'm doing it. I'm getting a success. You know, I'm getting somewhere with him. This is also really hard to hear. And now my father is feeling something else, which is guilt. Like, I'm doing it. I'm getting the success. But it's horrible what I'm hearing. I'm feeling proud about this. Like, what? The latter half of this morning conversation with Gary focused on one victim in particular, a victim that Gary claimed that he had some emotional attachment to, the victim Carol Christensen. There was oddities attached to her case that always nagged at my father and made her stick out. And so he had some kind of connection with her. I don't want to overstate it, but she represented something to him, I think. And so they got Gary to talk about killing this woman. And up until that point, Gary refused to really take responsibility for wanting to kill these women. He always blamed it on them. There was something about, like, he just wanted sex. And then they did something to not satisfy him, or he got scared and he snapped and he killed. And my father hated this kind of blame shifting.
He hated that Ridgway was saying these women triggered him, that it was their fault.
That's right. My father hated the fact that this man was blaming the women, really, for him killing them. And what he wanted to hear from Gary is, I did it. I didn't just want to, like, have sex with these women. I wanted to destroy these women. My dad wanted to hear him take responsibility for destroying these lives. So he kind of led Gary down this sort of just very logical road of just making him aware, look, you knew what you were doing. You have responsibility for the pattern that you see emerging in your life, but you didn't do anything about stopping it. So you, from the moment you picked up these women, you knew you wanted to kill them, didn't you? And Gary finally said yes, and he finally confessed to that. And my hearing that just devastated my dad. It was what he wanted to hear, but it was also hard to hear. And he said in that moment, Gary, you've touched me. and he said, I need to take a break. And my dad, who, if you listen to the tape of him interviewing Gary during this session, he's struggling to keep it together. And he leaves and he goes to another room and he breaks down and cries.
Finally, Ridgway is convicted.
Yeah.
And your father can be done with this case that he's spent nearly 20 years working on.
Yeah.
What was that like for your father once Ridgway was finally put away for these murders?
My dad says that there's only been a handful of times in this whole case that he has shed tears over it. One was that morning on the fifth day when he got Gary to confess to the things that he confessed to. But one of the other times was on the day in which he finally was in court and heard Gary Ridgway plead guilty to all of these things. And he cried. And I think it was relief. I think it was despair. It was just be able to finally release all of the emotions, frustrations of 20 years of keeping it all inside and being strong and tough for his family, for his community, for the case, to be at the end of it. I mean, it was just catharsis for a lot of complicated emotions that I don't think we have words for, you know.
Jeff Jensen is author of Green River Killer, A True Detective Story. He spoke with Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix. Well, we couldn't possibly get to the end of a show on Northwest myths and legends without including this guy. That's the sound of what might be the most enduring myth in the Northwest, Bigfoot. Of course, what I really mean is that's allegedly the sound of something that the vast majority of people say don't exist. Most of that so-called evidence for Sasquatch is pretty sketchy, but there are actually a few people who have made it their mission to do a scientifically rigorous investigation of the Sasquatch phenomenon. And one of them is Dr. Jeff Meldrum. He's a professor of anatomy and anthropology in the Department of Biological Sciences at Idaho State University. And I am giving his full title so you can understand, this is a credentialed scientist here. And he's preparing for one of the largest science-driven hunts for Bigfoot to date. And he says he got serious about Sasquatch when he encountered some evidence that he couldn't just write off.
I was traveling through Washington. The opportunity presented itself to visit someone who had a lot of evidence, the footprint casts, which I was very keenly interested in. He showed me a long line of tracks, 15-inch tracks. There were 35, 45 individual footprints. Very clear, unmistakable. I mean, these either had to be a very clever hoax or this was the real thing. And that's what kind of made the hair literally stand up on the back of my neck is as I, from my perspective of expertise, considered these remarkable footprints, it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. My gosh, a Sasquatch just walked by here last night. That really set the hook. I didn't see how I could walk away from this evidence.
So how would you kind of assess the state of Bigfoot research as it stands now? I mean, you said that these footprints were some of the most compelling evidence you had seen. How would you size up the field?
Well, I've been at this for nearly 20 years, and I have perceived that there is a shift in attitude. This really came, was driven home with the recent discovery of Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, as it's commonly known, this diminutive hominin in Southeast Asia that for which skeletal remains have now been found that are just a few tens of thousands of years old, which is a snap of the fingers in geologic time. The prospect that there could be branches of a very bushy family tree persisting alongside us, even into the present, isn't so far-fetched anymore.
So in pursuit of that question, you have a pretty elaborate research project in the works. Can you explain what it consists of?
Yes, I was approached by a gentleman who actually had an encounter, a close encounter with a Sasquatch in the northern Sierras a number of years ago, and he became just engrossed with the challenge of confirming that experience. And after consultation with many engineers and designers and pilots and so forth, he settled on an aerial survey approach and determined that the best way to do that would be a lighter-than-air ship, a helium-filled drone that could be flown at a considerable altitude and would have enough capacity for a long-duration flight with enough payload to accommodate very high-end thermal imaging equipment to try to make identify to make contact with a hot object that might fit the profile of a large bipedal primate. And then, of course, verify that on the ground with a ground insertion team. And they will spend at least a six-month period, 24/7, surveying on the ground a potential site for ultimate deployment of this airship, which is dubbed the Aurora.
And the Aurora, it's a drone? I mean, you're using a drone to hunt
Sasquatch.
That's right.
Now, it's different than what most people might envision when they hear the word drone. It's a 35-foot dual air cell catamaran-style airship, you know, like a miniature Hindenburg, only we'll hope that it doesn't have the same fate as the Hindenburg. And, you know, that's when the work really begins. You know, a creature like this, if indeed they exist, they're nocturnal, they're rare in the environment, they're very far-ranging, very, very generalized in their diet. That profile makes for a very difficult species to study in its natural setting.
You did say, you know, if Sasquatch exists, does that mean that you are agnostic at this point, or do you believe that it's out there? It's mm-hmm. You're open to the possibility that it's not. Where do you stand with that?
In the colloquial use of the term "believe," you know, do you believe in this? It usually connotes a position more akin to faith or the acceptance in the absence of evidence. Whereas, but for me, belief has no bearing on it. As a scientist, I am grappling with the evidence at hand, and on the basis of that evidence, you know, personally, I'm quite convinced.
What do you think the chances are of you finding Sasquatch?
Oh, I think they're pretty good. I mean, I have spent months and months at a time in the field, on the ground, surveying for trace and physical evidence, and have found on, you know, more than a half a dozen occasions footprints that I can't attribute to any other form of wildlife or human, hair samples that defy attribution to any known wildlife species. You know, so given that, being able to coordinate a ground effort with that eye in the sky, I think will just broaden the prospects and increase the chances of us detecting something.
Let me ask you this, Professor Meldrum. I mean, if you don't find anything, at what point does it, I mean, is there a point at which it makes sense to stop looking?
Well, I think that point's quite far away. I can't see that happening in my lifetime, quite honestly, because of the things that have occurred, the things that, the conclusions that I have drawn through my personal research. Now, the onus is still upon me to disseminate those conclusions more effectively, perhaps, to my colleagues, and to see a shift in the attitudes generally.
What have you given up, or what challenges has this presented to you professionally and personally?
Well, I have a thick skin, and it takes a lot to get under it. But when it has come to periods of evaluation for advancement or for promotion and tenure, there have been some unfortunate behavior on the part of a number of my colleagues. It's often, you know, the reaction from even within my department, which is a bit of a microcosm of the broader scientific community, has, as you might expect, spanned the gambit. And so it was an eye-opening experience to jump into that deep end of the pool and realize that rather than throwing you a lifeline, there were people with poles to push you under the surface. So I'm certainly more more realistic in my attitudes towards the conduct of science and the politics, you know, to be blunt, the politics of science.
Jeff Meldrum is a professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. In fact, they did like everything this week. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer, and our online managing editor is Martha Kang. You can learn more about our show at kplusoundeffect.org, and you can get in touch at soundeffect@kplu.org. Come on back next week for a healthy dose of failure.
Every writer knows rejection, and so to have a band of authors, it just seemed natural to be rejections.
That's next week on Sound Effect. You're listening to 88.5 KPLU.